Al, I want to ask you a couple of other timeline questions, since you had some very interesting things to say about the Cuban Missile Crisis. Do you remember the news of the launch of Sputnik?
Oh, I do.
What was that? What do you remember about that, and what impact
did it have? I just remember that we were all amazed and dumbfounded, and the overall opinion was we're falling behind.
Yeah.
But Sputnik is what really gave impetus to the space program.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
were you in Japan when that happened?
No, I was in San Francisco. So
you were in San Francisco?
Yes.
Doing, what were you doing there?
I was a public information for the 4th Air Force.
Okay. So you had spent a little bit of time in the Bay Area then?
Yeah.
And posting there before you went to San Antonio?
Yeah, yes.
Okay.
Beautiful area. Nice.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, very nice. Did that the launch of Sputnik have any particular impact that you remember?
It stimulated the intelligence services to train more Russian linguists, which I became one.
Okay. And did you do some further language instruction then, where you were teaching?
Yeah, after I finished. After I finished language training and was sent to NSA. I was expected to teach other people what I knew of Russian, and at the same time take more advanced classes myself.
Mm-hmm.
And then, later on, after I retired, I spent 23 years teaching Russian.
Here in Texas.
Level. And then, of course, I married a Russian wife, and I'm learning more.
And I want to ask you about her too, because that and include that story here, as it's a very interesting one. We'll come along to that. Al, do you remember the president, President Kennedy, being shot, that assassination?
I do.
Where were you?
I was in San Antonio.
Okay. What happened that day? Did you go to work like normal?
I
you were at work.
Work like normal, and.
Uh-huh.
I remember the first thing I said. I said, "Where is John Swayze? He was a friend of mine who hated Kennedy."
Okay. So once you clear that,
it was kind of a joke.
Yeah.
Well, I was appalled, like everybody else.
Did the intelligence agencies get busy that afternoon? Did you see any activity?
They were busy before that.
And
a few things happened that even today I'm kind of reluctant to mention publicly.
Okay, okay.
But I'll tell you privately what happened.
Okay, that would be fine. But you were...
I was working in plans and programs.
Mm-hmm. And did you feel a sense of loss at the present?
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
All these tragedies. And there for a while, I like everybody else. After his brother got shot and Dr. Martin Luther King got shot, I thought we were coming unglued as a nation, yeah.
What was your opinion of Johnson at that time?
Well, I disliked Johnson,
mm-hmm.
but I liked some of the things he did.
Mm-hmm.
I knew he was a ruthless person that would walk over anybody in a minute who opposed him or got in his way. At the same time, he had a feel for people because of his own hardscrabble background,
yes.
I guess.
Yes.
And had it not been for him, I don't think the civil rights movement would get off the ground as well as it did. But I admired him in a lot of ways. And I've been to his ranch, I guess 12 times, and every time I go, it gives me I guess I'm getting older and more understanding. But I learned to appreciate Johnson more and more, but never really like him.
Mm-hmm.
On a personal basis, I think we wouldn't be compatible. As president, he did all right.
He did all right?
I think so.
Okay. The Gulf of Tonkin incident in 1964, did you have any professional relationship through the intelligence agencies with that?
No. In 64, a guy was out of everything, but I heard of the Gulf of Tonkin. I wonder if that's really true.
Yeah. New research is showing that there's some problems around.
We antagonized them.
What was presented,
But I had a lot of thoughts about Vietnam as it happened, before it happened, and while it was happening. But I was never a fervent hawk or what do they call it? Dove. I was mostly curious, and I went to Vietnam, I'd say more out of curiosity and greed than anything else.
Out of greed?
Greed, yeah. I was curious, but when I found out, when the people, I never even thought about it until these people came to my house to recruit me.
Who came to your house?
God knows, they were from the State Department. Probably the CIA, I don't know who they were.
How many?
Two.
Nice guys?
Nice.
In
nice.
Suits?
They're,
a little bit?
Yeah, they were retired from their jobs, wherever they worked. And they told me about Vietnam. I was curious. I thought, well, I'll go over there and just take a look for myself.
What year would this have been?
This was in 65, I think.
65?
65.
And
I asked them how much the salary would be, and they told me. And I was drawing my retired pay as a colonel, and I was teaching school at the time.
Sure.
And I wasn't getting rich, but you know, I could pay the bills and whatnot, and I wasn't especially hurting for money. So then I asked them, how much would I make? They said, well, your salary will be, and they told me, in addition to that, you'll get a housing allowance, and you'll get it's called separate maintenance allowance, and you can continue collecting your pension. I said, well, add it all up, what's it come to? It came to close to, I think it was $87,000. $87,000, which in that time and day was a lot of money.
It's a pretty good sum now.
Yeah. And I my wife said, Yeah. Anyway, I was under the mistaken impression that salaries weren't taxable. They weren't if you worked for a private company, but if you worked for the government, taxes took out about 40%. I didn't make as much money as I thought. But Grace and I started talking about, well, we can pay off the house and put money aside and send the kids to school when they're coming along, and give it a try. And so, out of curiosity, but mostly greed, I signed up. And even during the war, I was never on one side of the other. I thought, as soon as I got there, we shouldn't be here. And our national unity was never really threatened by. And I doubted everything I saw just about, but I still worked hard to do my job, which was working with the refugees.
Now, when those guys came to talk to you, Al, did they explain to you that what they wanted you to do, what they were thinking of for you, was refugee work?
And I think they let me know that they knew that I'd been in intelligence reporting.
Sure.
And that I had a history of getting along with foreigners. Big old gooks. Well, I shouldn't say that.
That's okay.
No, getting along with foreigners.
Sure.
And they didn't say use that word, but I had a vague idea of what I was doing, but I don't think they really knew. And when I got to Vietnam, I found out nobody knew anything about anything. And what happened when I finally got to Vietnam, I was putting in a holding pattern.
Right.
All these people just like me sent from God knows where to this headquarters in Saigon. And you'd ask what your job was. Well, don't get to it. And just to keep you out of their hair, they'd say, you're going to be the refugee operations officer. And anytime we have trouble anywhere, we're going to send you there. And this is what they did. And I first of all, I lived in a very posh hotel, which I couldn't believe. And I didn't, when I went to pay the bill, they said, there's no bill to pay, you know, the government pays that.
Which hotel was it?
Regina Hotel.
The Regina,
But from there, I was eventually given a beautiful villa on Pasteur Street. It had an iron fence around it and moon guards in the front and the back. And it had three or four bathrooms and living room and dining room, came with two maids. And I couldn't believe it. And I hated it. The big, beautiful one. Well, before I hated it too much, you know, I eventually made a few friends. I remember we had a few parties in my house and had beautiful tile floors. We had bicycle races in my living room. And it was so unreal. All this time I was supposed to be the refugee operations officer. And there'd be some place 200 miles away where death and destruction and whatnot. And they said, Al, limousine will pick you up tomorrow morning, take you 10 on the airport, and you'll fly off to so-and-so, and so-and-so will meet you, and so forth. So I'd get up in the morning, and the maids would have a big breakfast and food brought off the black market, and bacon and eggs and toast and coffee and whatnot. A big table all by itself. Exactly 8 o'clock or whatever, and the big black limousine would pick me up and take me out to 10-something at the airport. I'd go winging off to God knows where. And usually I'd be met by the province senior advisor, the refugee advisor, and they'd take me another 25 miles in the hills where there had been a ground attack the night before and people killed and whatnot. And I'd come back and write my reports. And after a while, I got to be kind of a problem. I never knew who my boss was. I'd call him my boss of the day. You know, I'd find somebody who would accept my report, and I don't know what they did.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, it was kind of like that. And I didn't come over here to live like this and do this. I began agitating. I went down to personnel, and I'd tell them this. And I think as an act of meanness, they said, we're going to fix this bastard's ass. We're going to send him out. See if John Van can use him. John Van, I didn't know John Van, but I was beginning to hear about him. John Van will send his ass out to get shot off. And they don't take care of him. Anyway.
We won't be hearing from him again.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, eventually I was sent out, and John Van was looking for an activist kind of guy, and he had interviewed quite a few people, and I came along, he hired me, and we got along famously.
Now,
and from then on, I had a real job. But all this that I was doing was really good training, because I got to see all of Vietnam.
Yeah.
I got up into the mountain yard areas where I later worked. But I had a good feel for the DMZ to the Delta, from the China Sea to Laos and Cambodia. I just covered it all.
You were all over the place.
All over the place. And I got in a lot of dangerous, tight scrapes that I didn't have sense enough to avoid and whatnot.
Now, Al, the year that you arrived over there was what year? 66?
66.
Okay, about what month? Do you remember?
December.
And late 66.
The reason 66. I remember, I've been reading all these reports about the sheriffs in Saigon throwing hand grenades and
yes.
so forth. And I was met by... They appoint people called your sponsors. I even forget who they were or not. And I was telling you, I was a 33-hour flight to get to Vietnam. And all I wanted to do was go to bed anywhere.
Yeah.
But I was met by my sponsors, who thought the best way to introduce a new person to the Saigon was taking on the town. And we went to this garish nightclub where they had these beautiful Vietnamese gals doing bumps and grinds to the strain of Silent Night, Holy Night. I appreciate it, but I still wanted to. I finally got to the hotel or wherever. So that was my first night in Saigon, and it was kind of eerie.
Surreal, almost.
Surreal, yeah.
Especially when you're sleep deprived.
Yeah.
Al, you said that while in the period before you went up to work with General Van, that you went all over the country on different observation missions, I guess,
yeah.
To write summary reports of what had been going on. What was the security situation in general? Can you describe what was happening late 66, early 67?
There were isolated terrorist incidents all the time, and it was always a concern. These automobiles we drove in were always, especially when you go to the USAID headquarters, and was inspected with mirrors for bombs and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And now and then things happen, but generally not. I was always a little bit concerned driving around like that, but after a period of time, nothing happened. You just accept it and
get on with it.
Yeah, nothing happened.
Did you have a couple of tight scrapes during this period?
No, not in Saigon.
How about outside?
Oh, all the time.
Can you name one or two and tell me what you remember about it?
Well, There were so many of them that the, in that tape in the book I tell about them. But the tight scrapes I was in. Well, let me just start with Tet. Everybody's heard of Tet.
Okay, now this is when you were. This is later when you were working with John.
No, nothing happened to me inside now.
Okay.
On these trips I made. You always went to very bad areas. Suddenly, I was flown back to my home the same day.
Yeah,
it was surreal. And I'd be back home and have a nice big bed to sleep in, and the maid would have supper prepared and whatnot.
Did you have your own helicopter that you were moving in and out with?
Not then, no.
Okay.
I never had my own helicopter. John Van had his, and very often I would use his when he wanted to have me investigate something that was not more than 100 miles away.
So for most of 67, is it true to say you were living in Saigon but flying out?
Not most. I was only in Saigon maybe 4 months.
Okay, 4 months, and that's when they decided to...
And then I went out to John Van.
In Three Corps.
Three Corps, and that's when the bulk of the enemy activity was centered on Three Corps, and
yes.
I ran into one...
one thing after another.
But most of them that I write about here were... right after Tet.
Al, tell me your first impression. Do you remember the first time that you met John Van? Can you tell me what happened that day?
I was insulted by Frenchie.
Okay, that would be Frenchie Zouave, his secretary.
Yeah, Frenchie McDaniel. Frenchie had been with John, a total of 15 years, but she'd been with him all the time he was in Vietnam.
Right.
Frenchie was, a very sensitive, efficient, beautiful, wonderful person, but she put on this front, especially when she's under stress, that made you think otherwise.
Okay. But she's a charming gal.
She is. She's a wonderful woman.
What happened that day?
Well, I said, "Excuse me, miss, can I see John?" And she said, "Who the hell are you? What the hell are you doing here? Can't you see I'm busy? Get the hell out of here." And at that moment, I think John Van was again being interviewed by David Halberstam.
Okay, yes.
And not only that, she had an awful lot of responsibility and things to do all the time.
Oh, sure.
And she always had these people from God knows where stumbling into the office, and now I can understand her. But I nobody ever talked to me like that. And I said to this guy, "Who in the hell is that bitch?" He said, he said, "That's Frenchie." He said, "You'll find out. She's really not like that." Well, eventually, I had to go through Frenchie again. She got me an appointment with John. He's expecting me. And he spent half a day talking to me.
Now, he was interviewing you for that job.
Yes.
What kinds of things did he throw at you? How
wondering
did it
where I came from and what my politics were. And he wanted to know, he wanted to make sure that I was somebody that... Well, let me first of all tell you, he had a refugee officer who was a career State Department employee.
Yeah.
Very tall, distinguished looking man. He had a great white mustache and wavy white hair. He was a good employee. But he was Van called him a dilly-dallier. There'd be refugee problems somewhere. He'd tell this guy, "I want you to go here and do the..." And the guy had to make a staff study. Then he had to make charts and graphs. Then he had to give briefings about where he's going, what he's going to do. And John Van, he drew John Van crazy. Oh, and this guy had a white mustache, a white watch band, white socks, white shoes, white... I mean, he looked like State Department, Foreign Service Officer. He was a good man, but he wasn't what John Van wanted.
Not for that
Van wanted a guy who would immediately go where you might get your ass shot off and come back and tell me what the problem and then solve it. Thinking do that? I'll try. Well, after the first week of working with Van, I sat down and said, "This is insane. Nobody can survive doing this."
Do you mean the pace or the types of things?
No,
or
the places where you went and the things you had to do. You know, working with people who not were suspected of Viet Cong, but were Viet Cong, you knew it. We were going in areas where sometimes there were ground attacks and sniper attacks and roads mined, and just driving in Three Corps was worth your life.
Yeah.
And I got to think, how can anybody survive? But over a period of time, I guess I was like John Van, I got used to it. And I accepted it. But I wasn't there steady. Every 3 months, I came home for a month.
Really?
Yeah. And I didn't realize it, but I was under an awful lot of stress and didn't realize it, because every time I'd come home, I had to calm down.
Calm down. Mm-hmm.
And I found this out when I went to renew my commercial pilot's license after the Tet Offensive.
Uh-huh.
The doctor said, your blood pressure is terrible, your eyesight's not what it should be, your heart is this, and went on and on and on. And I said, well, I can't understand it, because and he said, I can't understand you passing the last time if you're like this. And I said, well, I never seem to have any problems. I get regular checkups. And he said, what do you do for a living? And I told him. He said, oh, good God, he said. And that could be it. He said, why don't you just take it easy for a couple of weeks and we'll try it again. And after 3 weeks, I came back and I calmed down. And my blood pressure was normal and everything else. And I passed. But I was under a lot of pressure and strain all the time.
And that started right away.
Oh, I'm sure it did.
Like the first week you were working for Van.
Yeah, and it stayed with you all the time you were there.
When, Al, if you remember, as historians are very interested in General Van, when did you, if you remember, actually begin working for him?
That day.
And was that in 60, it was in late 67?
67, yeah.
Late 67 sometime?
Yeah. And I started that very day.
Do you know what happened to this fellow with the State Department get-up?
Well, let me tell you something else.
What happened to him?
He was supposed to give me an introduction to what I was going to be doing.
Uh-huh.
His main preoccupation was raising orchids.
Oh, boy.
He lived in a nice air-conditioned apartment in Saigon. And he took me out to some wild places, I mean, where we shouldn't have been, and where I found out later we should have been killed. But what he was doing, he was spotting buffalo dung here, there, and everywhere. He had a little sack, and he'd get out and get his buffalo dung to bring back for his orchids.
Okay, being kind, yeah. Was that, do you think, his way of calming down? Or do you think he never...
I don't want to be too hard. He was a good man, I'm sure. But he was not the activist. John Van wanted to go here and now and do it and come back and go back and fix it.
Was John Van someone who had high blood pressure and was going all the time and never slept?
He was going all the time. He was a dynamo, he was here, there, and everywhere. And John Van knew more about Vietnam, its people, and its problems than anybody I ever met.
Where was your headquarters? Where was the base in Three Corps?
Well, when I first worked for John Van, I lived in this ridiculous house. I had to drive to Benoit every day.
To Benoit, uh-huh.
And that was onerous. And eventually, I moved out to Benoit, and I lived in a house next door to Frenchie. And this was a typical Vietnamese house. It was probably about as wide as this room, but it was this living room, dining room, kitchen, and bedroom. Uh-huh. Bedroom and kitchen. And this is where we lived, so I was working out of that house. But generally, I was traveling so much, I wasn't home much. I stayed in these villages at night. And sometimes I'd go out and stay for 2 or 3 days. But when I was home, I lived in Benoit, and I was in Benoit when the Tet Offensive started, and the brunt of the Tet Offensive was in an area around my house. But that's where I got to know Frenchie, too.
Okay, because you live next door. What about your other counterparts who had responsibility for other areas like police and civic action and those? Do you remember any of those guys?
I remember them all.
Can you name some of their names?
Well, let me think. The guy in charge of health is Dr. Passaccia. I remember him.
Uh-huh.
Charge of health. Who got stalled during the Tet Offensive. He couldn't fly out of the United States to his job in Vietnam.
I heard about that. Mm-hmm.
And I was the director of refugees. And Dr. Rose was in charge of education. And I forget the name, the guy with the name in charge of the police, but Van had these, I think, five or six directives: refugees, police, education, health, medical care, and civil engineering. And he'd have a staff meeting almost every morning where we all would discuss what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody did their best to keep Van appraised, and nobody could pull the wool over his eyes because he knew more about what we're all doing than we knew. Not only that, you could tell him you're doing this and doing that, and then you'd leave and be maybe 100 miles away, and he'd drop in the helicopter to save you.
Mm-hmm.
And so he knew. But all these people, we would meet occasionally like that at the staff meeting, but then you'd never see them the rest of the day. And a lot of them, I worked with a lot of people I'd see and not see and just forget.
Right. Well, it sounds like, as we'll discuss this afternoon, you had your hands full with plenty of things that you were up to.
Yeah, and don't forget, Vietnam had 44 provinces.
Yes.
Each province, it's after the pattern after the old French system, each province had several districts, 2 to 4 districts.
Mm-hmm.
And in most of these, there was a Vietnamese province senior advisor with his American counterpart. And they also was a refugee advisor, American advisor, Vietnamese counterpart. And generally speaking, people in the areas where I worked and were responsible for would do what had to be done. Occasionally they didn't, and then John and Van and I would take further action.
Right.
But it was a big organization. I think John and Van probably had 6,000 people that he was responsible for. And I guess I was responsible for all the refugee advisors in the provinces and districts and whatever corps I was in. But normally, they were competent and did their job, and it wasn't as hard on me as you might suspect.
Now, let's take a break here, Al.
Okay.
Okay.